it hurts my brain that it's not obvious to everybody. Or it could also mean that I'm just the biggest idiot on the planet too. You know?
It's still really, really, really hard in order to get AI to do useful work at scale repetitively. How early we are, how hard some of these problems are, and then the scale at which people are just pouring money into this, assuming that they're going to get economic payback here in the near term. The economy isn't made to take care of you.
Capitalism is a game.
Yep.
Does it feel like to you like the entire world is about to get massively disrupted and all the players, like it's actually happening, and a lot of the behavior we're seeing from these companies is exactly that? So like for the Uber CEO to come out and say a statement like that, for them to announce a $20 billion buyback, I think it was, over the course of how many years? Like, I don't know. It's like, it just feels like, I don't know. It's a weird time. Because everything just feels weird.
Well, I've been trying to process Dwarkesh's comments recently. And I think the state of AI right now is a lot less exciting in the near term than most people think. We're still underestimating what it can do long term also. But I feel like we're probably very, you know, internet.com bubble type season right now of thinking AI is going to do all this in a bag of chips.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's still really, really, really hard in order to get AI to do useful work at scale repetitively. And I think anyone who is trying to do all of this has the same exact types of experiences that we've had as we've tried to, you know, incorporate more and more AI into things. It's like, yeah, it's just like, it can, there are spots of brilliance. It's going to be incredible, but right now it still requires so much scaffolding and so much hand-holding, and massaging, and then just like human hand-holding in order to get it to be able to actually produce stuff that you can use in some sort of a professional context. And I think that's really, I mean, that's why Palantir has such a crazy valuation, is because it's some of the premier AI scaffolding that, you know, a business can just go out and purchase to start getting more use out of this stuff. And I think that's going to be true for a while still. I think like we're just going to be driving down the amount of scaffolding that's necessary over time, in a continuous fashion. We're not like, I don't see any huge step changes on the horizon, but that doesn't mean that there's not one. You know, maybe there is. Like the point that Dwarkesh made about the fact that, you know, it doesn't really do situational, like contextual learning, where you can drop it into your application, the job that it needs to do, and then it can do the job and then learn and get a little bit better the next time, and do that continuously.
Yeah.
And the way that AI is trained right now, that's not even possible. Like this is gets into the conversations that Larry has, where he says that, you know, we need there to be some sort of a tighter feedback loop between training and inference in order to do those adjustments on the weights and, you know, the memory and all that stuff, to where you're actually, you know, creating something that can learn how to do useful work like a human. And it is like, if you think about this from an evolutionary context, we built on this massive reasoning brain, like at the very end of a very long evolutionary process that, like, you know, all sorts of mammals and birds and reptiles and all this stuff, like they have all sorts of intelligence that doesn't necessarily do the same thing that we can do with the height of our reasoning brain and the neocortex that we built on top of all those lower types of things. And that's the stuff that we're about to try to build that we haven't even really started building yet. So we're like going in reverse order. We tried to build this reasoning brain and that has this incredible capacity to memorize, like, you know, all the facts on Earth, but, you know, put it in a little mouse body and tell it to go survive for the next 2 billion years in the wild.
Yeah. I think it's dead tomorrow.
And it's toast. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's, we don't know how hard is it going to be to do those things. Maybe it's not going to be that hard. Maybe it's going to be really hard. Like if the evolutionary process is a guide, then that suggests that maybe that stuff is harder. And that's the kind of stuff that we need, you know, optimists to do. And we need, like, the fact that robotaxi's working, that's pretty awesome. That's just like one narrow use case of this type of a niche. And hopefully
it's dumb AI.
It's dumb, you know, it's baby AGI.
Single purpose.
But yeah, very, very baby. And, you know, it has to operate within the boundaries of, you know, this world that we as humans have built up for cars. You know, it doesn't just go off and work anywhere and everywhere all the time. Yeah, it is kind of mind-boggling to think about
just how early,
how hard, yeah, how early we are, yeah, how hard some of these problems are, and then the scale at which people are just pouring money into this, assuming that they're going to get economic payback here in the near term. But, you know, different business models have different ways to monetize. Like, I think that Google is in a great spot with their ability to use AI to generate insights in their business that then translate into earnings. Meta, you know, that thing that Elon dropped yesterday on the advertiser thing, how they're integrating Grok into their advertising platform. And you think about how Grok will get better at understanding the world overall as it observes, you know, these transactions and tries to make these predictions on what are good products, you know, what's a good product for which person, what's that person going to be interested in, will they click on it, will they not, like all that stuff. You know, those types of opportunities really do give us legs to continue moving forward. It's not like we're just going to hit this wall, but yeah, I think things are definitely harder than most people understand. But at the same, like, you know, websites were really hard to build, and then all of a sudden they got a lot easier over time, and the number of them grew exponentially. And it's easier today than it's ever been to spin up a website. We're early in that type of application.
Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellion Air. Now, we know a lot of you are Tesla fans, and especially Tesla investors. And if you have more than $1 million of Tesla stock, Rebellion Air could be the perfect fit for you. Rebellion Air is an investment firm that helps Tesla investors reach their financial goals. They do this by helping you plan for your future, and they also institute strategies like trimming and adding, covered calls, etc. So if you're somebody who believes that Tesla has long-term potential, these kinds of strategies could maximize the number of shares you have by the time Tesla reaches those goals. And the guys at Rebellion Air do this by doing so much research on the Tesla story, and they do a lot of novel research as well. Things like doing cross-country full self-driving trips to really gauge and truly understand the capability of that specific software. They've done really novel research around the energy side of the business and other parts of the business as well. And so instead of dealing with a typical investment firm that may give you the cold shoulder by viewing your investment as too risky, the guys at Rebellion Air will help you reach your goals while fully understanding the Tesla story. And so if you're a Tesla investor and you have more than $1 million of shares, and you're interested in finding out more about Rebellionaire, I have a link for you in the description in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionaire.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that we sent you. And now back to the podcast.
The more I think about it too, it's like, I think Dwarkesh is probably 100% right. And like, if I use today's GPT-5 presentation as like an example, so we have one of the preeminent, if not the leader, let's say from the perception of the public, of an AI company, and their presentation today, from my perspective, was very like, it was just a small step forward. That's what it felt like, which sort of speaks to that idea that, hey, we're actually much farther away from a transformative thing happening in AI than what it feels like or what it seems like out there in the discourse. You know, it's just like, it's rounding out the edges of a thing that's already doing a bunch of really cool stuff, but like, it's just making that cool stuff better. It's not introducing more or different kinds of cool stuff. And the applications in the digital realm, they feel much more finite and a lot less impactful, especially if you're an investor or somebody who's thinking about like the true long-term impact of this technology. The digital world compared to the physical world, the TAM of the physical world for AI is probably, what, infinitely larger than the digital world, potentially? Because how much can you do in the digital world, theoretically? It's like, a lot of it is like, it's brain tasks, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'd be curious to see what is the global TAM of knowledge work versus the rest of the economy. I think that's basically the split.
What is the TAM of knowledge work versus the rest of the economy globally? Yeah?
Yep.
All right. Grok 4 heavy, going to work. Yeah, exactly it. So like, you know, intuitively, solving for human or robots, self-driving cars, drones, all of them in autonomous, right? Construction. That feels like a TAM that's much bigger than a coding agent. You know, and or a content creator. You know, I mean, the entertainment industry is pretty large. You know, so it's like a lot of these things could be like anything that shows up in a screen theoretically is like what the digital world of AI could disrupt. But the digital world, just intuitive, like the last podcast we had where you mentioned is like, hey, going to Mars, going to other universes, like zooming into like the minutiae of reality, then expanding all the way to the macro level and like really doing a bunch of AI cycles on that. That is like completely untapped, like actually understanding reality for what it is and all the potential in there. That feels much farther, like that is way farther away than a perfect coding agent or much farther away than a perfect content creator. So it's like the question becomes, like in my head, I'm like, okay, so what does that mean for, like, what does OpenAI do moving forward? What does Google do moving forward? What does XAI do moving forward? I think I think the reason why people are so excited about Tesla is because they seem so well positioned for that next leg. Like, yep. If the hypothesis is like, okay, the next 3 to 5 years or the next 1 to 3 years. It's not going to be as fast or as rapid as people think, because you're going to be there's going to be walls in your way to really make an impact. In the physical world, it's a completely different problem. It's a completely different thing, because having a self-driving car that can drive you anywhere, it's like the disruption is obvious. Human or robots, same thing, right? So it's like embodied companies are the ones that are going to be huge.
Yeah, and that gives Tesla a real big advantage right now, because I think, you know, based on our experiences, the robotaxi application is pretty much there. Like, it's working in Austin. You know, sometime in the next 12, 18, 24 months, we're going to be reaching scale on these, and that becomes a massive revenue driver for Tesla. And then if it takes longer to really make these general application humanoid robots get to where they need to go, well, hey, at least you've got, you know, earnings from robotaxi that you can use to plow into that big fat problem. And I mean, does Figure have that? No. Like, they're, you know, if it's too early right now, Tesla can survive until the timing is right. If it's too early right now, Figure's fucked.
Right.
And, you know, we don't know if that is or is not true yet. But that's, you know, that's one of the really tough dynamics about all of this. So, yeah. And I think the other thing is true, where if you've got physical AI, the more you figure out physical AI, I think the more you can feed that back into making your digital AI smarter. Because that's the, you know, that's the path of human development, is first we figure out a world model, and then we build our reasoning and our language on top of the world model that we've already created. And that helps to constrain the outputs that, you know, our brain comes up with in reasoning, in language, to stuff that makes sense. And, you know, you hallucinate a lot less, you know, unless you're on mushrooms or LSD or something.
And just to define it, the world model, what you're talking about is like a carbon copy replica simulation of the physical, like of what exists in reality.
It's not a carbon copy. It's like a low resolution, like, you know, when you edit video files, you're working with proxies while you're editing. You know, it has like a super low bit rate.
360p versus 4K, basically.
Yeah. And then maybe it's dropping frames or whatever, just so that you can work with it back and forth. Like the world model that we as humans have is kind of like proxy files for editing video. And, you know, this is why, you know, anytime you really pay attention to something, you're like, oh wow, this is like way more complicated than I thought that it was. And, you know, it takes us thousands of years to figure out complicated physics that end up being really simple when you can finally see everything up close enough. But, you know, we can still live, we can still operate. Like, we're just, it just has to be low, you know, fine enough resolution to where you can survive and you can have kids and you can create a culture that allows your culture and your genes to proliferate, you know, hundreds of years into the future. And so, yeah, like, we don't need to have a perfect understanding of reality in order to accomplish those objectives. And that's why we're, you know, constantly learning. And that is the goal that Elon is pursuing with Grok, is to say, okay, let's actually generate a world model that's much closer to what you're talking about, that is the closest thing that we can come up with to an actual carbon copy of base level reality.
Which gives a pathway for the company. Like if you have that, you can basically solve for anything, right? Because you've identified everything. You've identified physics, you've identified human behavior, you've identified quantum mechanics, you've identified everything.
Yeah, just really, really figure out physics and then chemistry and biology, like, that would be huge. You know, physics is mostly figured out. You know, we don't really, really understand things at the very, very big or the very, very, very small in
Black
physics.
Holes are weird.
Yeah. But we've got it, you know, like, we'll say that humanity so far has like a 90% on physics. Chemistry, I don't know what it is, but it's definitely not 90%. Biology, we're like completely screwed. We don't understand jack shit.
We don't even know
biology. Yeah. It's like, and then neuroscience is like, you know, way less than even that. And so, yeah, if we have a 20% in biology, we're probably doing good. And neuroscience, yeah, probably not even that. So, yeah, we need to start moving some of those other fields higher and higher up into levels of understanding. And the reason that we don't understand those other things very well is because they're much more, like, physics is complicated. It's not necessarily that complex. Like, there's not that many different things that are interacting. together that produce whatever happens. And so it's a lot easier to isolate the variables. And yes, like the whole universe is super intricate and complicated. And when you look at it, you know, it seems like it's going to be a lot more complex than it is, but you know, it does collapse down to a few simple laws and a few simple math equations that, you know, then you can just replicate in massive, you know, nearly infinite numbers of calculations to get a decent understanding. But man, the number of different variables that come into play each successive level higher of hard science makes those things much, much more difficult to really wrap your head all the way around.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, if we could solve, you know, you're driving towards, if we could solve human behavior, like human behavior is way, way, way up towards the top of complicated things, yeah. In some ways. And so, yeah, I think we'll understand biology and neuroscience probably about the same time that we're getting human behavior.
I think what's fascinating about this time is that it feels like the pregnant pause before that. So it's like we came to the realization, say like, you know, when GPT first dropped, like everybody was like, holy shit, it happened. Then a few years have passed and it's like, wow, it's going to happen. And now we're all like,
what is it? Know? When is it going to happen?
And we know it's going to happen. We're just like, you know, like we're but in, that's why this time feels so awkward. It's obvious it's there. Like the comment you made, like the moments of brilliance when they happen, it's like, okay, obviously this is going to happen. When I take RoboTaxi down to Austin, obviously it's going to happen. When Grok 4 Heavy gives me like the absolute perfect, exactly what I want a response that I was completely mind blown that I generated. Obviously it's going to happen. When I create, you know, when I have one success of creating an end-to-end process of going from like idea to video creation, and it took me like 1/10 the time that it would have. Obviously this is just automatable. Like, why can't I just automate it? And then I do it the second time. And I'm like, just do what I tell you, you know? And then it's like constantly over and over and over again, but it's just right there. It's right there. And I feel like it almost feels like the world's largest door is locked. You can't see anything, but you see all those clues. Like you can hear people knocking on the other side. Are you there? You know, you can hear everything. And it's like, there just needs to be a little bit of a crack to open. And then you're going to start having people filter in to like this brand new universe. It's going to be like an infinite universe of possibilities or whatever. You know, it's like you're in this like dark closet, like knocking on the door, like get me the hell out of here, you know? It's so weird. It feels so uncomfortable because it's almost like, you know, we talk about that, like that transition is like, okay, so like once we're in that world, this is why it's so hard to understand what the hell is going to happen. Because once we go into that world, that disruption that comes with it is going to hit all of us in the face. We've talked, how many times have we talked about it on the channel? And we keep talking about
that's
it.
That's actually
because
the
we
thing
know it's going to happen.
That I'm, you know, maybe this gives me a little bit of hope in is that it's easy to think about this as something that all happens right at once. But if instead of it being this discontinuous, like slap humanity in the face in the course of 1 year or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, like if we really are at, you know, that peak where you're about to go down into the trough of disillusionment and then reality is going to kick in and it's actually going to happen, to where this whole thing does take significantly longer than we think it has, then we have a lot more time to adjust to those changes as they come in, you know, successive way. Instead of, you know, one big tsunami hitting the beach, if it's a whole bunch of, you know, 20, 30 foot waves or whatever that come in every so often, well, then you've got a lot better chance of surviving that type of a disruptive, you know, I guess, path into the future.
Yeah, that's very true. But I almost wonder, like, I do think that it needs to happen for there to be any action. I think there's just going to be a lot of inaction. That's if it happens slowly. I actually have a completely different take than you. If it happens slowly, I think there's going to be a increased backlog of the wrong actions. So it's like, okay, so if the transition happens slowly and it's like, okay, so disrupted, well, you can go work somewhere else. Disrupted, well, you can go work somewhere else. And it happens slowly. All the industries around are going to keep dumping more and more money into like, okay, AI, 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 AI. And so now you're going to create this like, almost like a spring effect where you're going to have all this capital and all this like effort to try and make this happen, that when it does happen, it happens much bigger than anybody expected, or it happens much quicker than anybody expected. I mean, I don't know if I'm verbalizing this correctly, but my fear is that if it does, because it is so disruptive, you know, there are so many different ways of hiding what was really going on in the economy. Like we see it with like just the way the Fed acts, right? The way our government tries to like fudge the numbers to make, you know, one administration says, well, this doesn't matter. The Biden administration, there's no recession. The Trump administration, fire the person. You know, it's like nobody knows the truth of what's actually happening. And so my fear is that because of this technology being so disruptive, that it happening slowly could actually have a worse effect, because you're giving people and companies and like the environment time to keep building in bad habits, or not even bad habits, like the forcing functions that are going to create a worse outcome in the long term for society. Does that make any sense? I don't even know if I verbalized what I'm thinking properly. It's rooted in the fact that I don't think the governmental system and societal system is going to be proactive enough to try to get ahead of the problem.
Yeah.
Is there still going to be a sudden shift?
So like that's what you are making an assumption there, that there's going to be a sudden shift.
Correct.
And maybe there is, maybe there's not. You know, that's it depends on how sudden is sudden and how big it is when it suddenly hits. I mean, that's certainly the future that a lot of people are worried about.
But we still don't know.
I just don't see how none of the ways that we are building any of this stuff right now lend themselves to something that is massive, like massive and sudden at the same time, because like we have to build the way that it works right now is
robotaxi.
You've got to build out more. Well, even that, like you've got to build out the fleet. Building out the fleet takes years. You're not like, you know, you didn't just fire every single Uber driver around the world at once. Like you can only fire them at the rate you fire them, like, you know, 3 drivers per car that comes off the end of the line. And so
there's 1 million active Uber drivers. So that's 300,000 cars.
Yeah. Which is a year.
It's nothing.
So, but then you also have to be able to, you know, deliver those to the location. Like there's other things. Maybe, you know, maybe the cars are not the limiting factor on that. Whatever it is, you know, it ends up being a little bit more, like it's fast, but it's not instant. But I think especially when it comes to just AI in general, like if we continue having to feed these chips with way more power, you know, manufacture the big fat chips in the first place, that, you know, there's not the only way that I would see that happening is if we get some sort of magic algorithmic breakthrough where all of a sudden you can use all the computing power that you have, you know, 100 times more efficiently than we do today. That would be the closest thing that I could see. Cause like, we're not going to build 100 times more energy instantly. We're not going to build 100 times more chips instantly. So it would have to be something like that. But even then you'd have to, okay, if you could use the compute that you had 100 times more efficiently, essentially overnight, then do you have the latent data necessary to really feed that much compute? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Like it would depend.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially. So yeah, you kind of have to look at it across all three, because you've got, you know, your critical inputs are going to be energy, they're going to be data, they're going to be compute, and they're going to be algorithms. And so, I mean, I think the available data is probably close to infinite compared with what we're actually using. So that one should be, you know, it's just then your ability to capture it and curate it that becomes the limitation there. Yeah, chips, you know, we're going to continue to grow our ability to produce them, but that's going to be a slow and continuous process. Energy, like I said, slow and continuous process, and then algorithms.
Yeah. So maybe the reality of the situation is we're going to have like smaller subsets of the economy are going to start getting disrupted one by one, like with these things.
Yes. And then even to build on that, you know, it can disrupt unregulated areas of the economy a lot faster than highly regulated areas of the economy. So you have that.
Yes.
You can almost think about it like if you're trying to dig a hole and the top of the hole is nice soft dirt, and then the further down you go, the more you get into rocks, and eventually you're just trying to drill through granite. Like diffusing AI into the most regulated sectors of the economy is almost like, you know, getting down to that bottom of the hole and having to really work your way through granite.
But the flip side of that is if you're an Uber driver in Texas, you probably want to have something figured out by the end of next year.
I mean, if you're working for Uber and you're not investing in Tesla stock, I don't know what you're doing. Like how
Uber drivers
not...
probably can't afford to invest in Tesla stock.
They can't afford not to. Like the cost of their future earnings that they're losing, like you just need insurance. Like if you're paying for insurance on your car, you should definitely pay for insurance on your income stream.
But that's my point, right? So what percentage of the, you know, we both agree that Uber drivers are incredibly hardworking people, like super, like obviously they're doing a very important job, but the reality is in states like Texas, it's likely that they won't have a job by the end of, like they won't be able to Uber drive by the end of next year. They might be able to still do Uber Eats for sure until, you know, Tesla figures out how to put a bot in the car. Then that's a different question. But if you're an Uber, so like the mechanics, let's walk through the mechanics, right? So So what happens to those drivers by the end of next year once Texas is fully open to robotaxi and it's half the price of Uber? What do those people do, right?
Well, they go into the workforce, or they, you know, I guess it depends on, you know, where they're coming from. Some of these people, this is just extra money and it's a side gig and they don't necessarily need that job in order to get by. For those people, they have the option to either just not do that portion of the work that they're doing, or, you know, go find something else.
I just asked Uber what percentage of Uber, or Grok, what percentage of Uber drivers do it part-time versus full-time? And the other query finished.
What was the answer on the other query?
So it gave me two, and they're it has an A-B test, and they're both different. Great. The one is 40 trillion are knowledge, 60 is everything else. The B result is 16 is knowledge, 95 is everything else.
16 and 95?
Yeah.
Those don't add up to 100.
The other one's 111. So,
yeah.
But then the first one, the 100 is right, but then the numbers are very round.
Yeah.
So it could be 60-40. I mean, that's probably right, honestly. So it's, you know, 40% of the global GDP is knowledge work, 60%. And it makes sense
basically
because we've
all of finance, insurance, like almost all that stuff is all knowledge work. And
but then the flip side of that argument, right, is like, so what's Peter Thiel's hypothesis is that the world of atoms has slowed down dramatically since we landed on the moon. So that $60 trillion percentage of the economy could probably be at $200 trillion or $300 trillion. But because we chose to focus on the digital world, that has come up to $40 trillion, and there's a laggard effect on the $60 trillion that's probably going to get to $200 trillion in the next 20 years or more.
Yeah, which, you know, I think largely depends on regulation. know, the reason that we can't do things in the physical world is because it's so heavily regulated and litigated.
So back to the Uber driver example. So as I asked, okay, so then, so then mechanically speaking, that's very,
percentage of the overall Texas economy does that account for? You know, are you talking about a 2% change in, you know, net employment in
Texas? Can the state absorb it?
And just, what, you know, some of those people are going to go on unemployment. Some of those people are going to do other things. Like, it's just going to be a diffusion, basically.
So I guess the question becomes, like,
it'll be a good first. I would say it'll be a good first. Thank you.
I had to do it. Sorry.
It'll be a good first data gathering cycle to see, you know, how many people, how fast, where do they go afterwards? You know, I think if I was someone in the state government in Texas, I would be right now gearing up to do a full scale data analysis on this to, like, bring people in, you know, have some way to track almost each and every one of these people who's driving for Uber through the next couple of years and see where they all go. Even if you don't have any plans to do anything to help any of these people, at least understanding the process that they go through. And, you know, maybe you do have some sort of a plan, but that would then inform, because we're going to have to start doing this in more and more areas. It sure would be nice to have an idea of how it works, you know, at a low level mechanically, to then try and have some intelligent answers.
Yeah, that's actually a really good idea. It's like literally track the headcount as it transitions away from Uber driving, like hauling people from point A to point B, how each one of those headcount, like, what fields or industries do they go to? Like, like, it's almost like it becomes such a great proxy for every other state, because let's say, you know, let's say Uber drivers like the flexibility, they can sort of make their own hours, right? They're comfortable in social situations. Okay, so flexibility in social situations. They're willing to take on a relatively risky job. You know, driving is not, you know, it's like 40,000 people die in the United States. You know, if you're a woman, you're especially vulnerable as an Uber driver, especially on, like, weekend nights. So it's not a risk-free job at all. So, like, that's sort of a profile of the individual. So what can't happen, and this is sort of my fear, what can't happen is that, okay, so a state has jobs available, but these jobs are a clear downgrade when it comes to the well-being of the individual when they transition out of the job they were doing that was disrupted by AI. So, like, just having jobs is not good enough. That's my big fear. It's like, okay, is the job an improvement to what they had? Because if it's not an improvement, this whole thing goes to shit. The whole thing goes to shit.
I mean, it's not like driving for Uber is a great job. So it is hard to have it be.
There are worse jobs.
I mean, there are worse jobs, but it's not like a ton worse jobs.
It's subjective.
One of the things that we may end up having to do as we go through this transition, you know, if stuff starts to get a lot cheaper over time.
Can I stop you there for a second, Hans? Because I think this is a very important point. You can't say that. That there are not that many worse jobs, because that is a completely subjective take from the individual. And that's why this whole thing is going to be so messy, right? Because let's say I used to be an Uber driver, but then now I have to go be a construction worker. But the construction worker, I get paid a little bit more, but then I just hate doing physical work. I hate picking up stuff and putting it down. Mm-hmm. I hate getting dirty. I hate getting dust on my face every day, right? I hate the job in general. That person is going to feel a lot worse off than being a driver, because they're giving up a lot of the comforts and a lot of the things that they liked about that job to work that job.
Well, it's a good thing construction's not the only new job that's available.
Okay, so go.
Yeah, they need a new, you know, sit on their butt job. They go work for the government.
I'm telling you, Hans, this is the problem. I'm telling you right now, like this is the problem. It's like it is a very subjective thing to transition from one job to another and feel like the economy's taking care of you. I mean, just look at the whole college debt situation.
The economy isn't made to take care of you.
Sorry?
The economy isn't made to take care of you.
You are projecting your personal feelings onto what is reality.
No, I'm telling you what is reality in reference to your subjective feelings.
Autism. No, but this is the problem. So how else do you describe the general feeling of like our generation and younger, especially that graduate of college with a bunch of debt, and now they all feel like they have to vote for communists in New York? That's a perfect encapsulation of what happens in that environment, because they were promised something or they felt like they had a situation that was going to work out, and then it didn't work out, and now they're pissed off. The same exact thing is going to happen to the Uber driver scenario if they don't have a new path that is subjectively better, not just objectively. It has to be subjectively better. They have to feel like they have a better path in front of them,
except the AI just tossing them aside. A whole job market that's full of all types of different jobs. You know, each person, the types of subjective jobs that they view as better is going to be different. But the job market overall, there's all kinds of jobs for all kinds of different people. And so it's not like the only, I mean, we have pretty much record low unemployment. So that is true for whatever 94% or 95% of job seekers today in America.
Record low unemployment, where we have record highs of people having to work multiple jobs because the jobs they work don't pay enough. This ain't going to end pretty. It's kind of where I'm getting at. I don't have confidence that this is going to end well. I don't have confidence that the next 10 years are going to be a net positive. I think the next 10 years are going to get ugly.
I think that's likely. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. More than likely. You know, it's not for certain, but definitely going to be pretty high risk.
So. The net impact, right? I mean, there are going to be winners. There's going to be huge winners. Like Tesla shareholders, not financial advice. I think they're going to be, it's going to be good. It's going to be very good. But you have to be in a privileged position to be able to do that in the first place. Like you have to buy into UBI of sorts. In this current model, you have to buy into UBI because Tesla's dividends are going to be so nuts from the bot and the robotaxi and their AI thing that those profits are going to be a direct result of profitability from their AI systems, and anybody who's a Tesla shareholder is going to be able to benefit from those dividends long term. But those that are disrupted by that AI, what do they get? They probably get a worse job until the new economy spools up. How long is that going to take?
Yeah, it'll definitely take a while. But the thing is that gap, you know, those people that need something to do. So here's my spicy take. I think we're actually going to have to lower the minimum wage, not raise it.
But as
productivity.
Thank you for proving my point.
In services and goods and services explodes, you may actually be richer in real terms on a lower minimum wage than you are today. So like, you know, your $5 may get you like a sit down restaurant meal in a not too distant future.
So walk through that. So your hypothesis is, even though real wages will go down, there's going to be massive deflation on the things that people care about. That's your argument?
That's one possibility, that if we can direct enough of this AI labor into producing real goods and services quickly, that we can do stuff. And then the stuff that people do, you know, maybe you can't make $20 an hour doing the same thing that you do today a few years from now, because that job went away. But maybe you could find a different job that doesn't pay quite $20 an hour, but you get more stuff for that $15 an hour in the future than you get today. Like, you're still better off overall in that future. And hopefully that's the direction that this trends towards. And yeah, I mean, I think it'll be, especially if that job that you can do for $15 an hour in the future aligns more with what you like to do than whatever you have to do today for the 20. And I think that's definitely going to trend in that direction, that there's going to be more opportunities to do more of the things that people like to do and get obsessed with in the future.
So I definitely agree with that long term. I think the biggest hurdle there is the individual convincing themselves. Yeah, convincing themselves that a smaller bank account is actually good for them. Think about that framing.
Well, I just don't think people pay close enough attention. That's my hopeful thing on this. Like, people don't realize today that they, you know, that they're spending twice as, most people don't even realize that they're spending twice as much today on groceries as they were just a few years ago.
Because their bank accounts have gotten bigger relative to where they used to be. That's why.
Yeah, or you know, their wages went up or whatever. Yeah.
That's what
I'm saying. But not as much as, yeah, yes. And so if you change these things over time, yeah, people can all of a sudden be like, wow, you know, it seems like I have more money left over at the end of the month to get the same things.
I want to say this very bluntly, and I hope nobody takes offense to this, okay? The autism world that we're going towards is not going to be absorbed well by most people. The very logical conclusion of, hey, just because you might be getting paid less and your bank account might be smaller, but look at how much cheaper everything else is. I don't think that's going to be absorbed well, because people are going to be like, yeah, but my bank account is smaller. This whole time, I've been working so hard to make enough money, okay? And now I'm getting paid less. I'm telling you, bro, that's the hurdle. So like UBI can't come in the form of, like, this is like, you know, people will go like, well, this is some World Economic Forum type shit, you know, like you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. You'll get paid less, but you'll be happier. Good luck fixing that. Good luck selling that frame.
You get paid less, but you'll own more and you'll be happier.
Yeah. Yeah. So like the real question becomes here is how wrong are we? Like, versus the actual, and this is where the comments would be super helpful. So if you're all watching this in the audience, let us know what you think in the comment section here.
Like, this is the hard thing about the singularity, is that, you know, your ability to predict what happens in the future basically goes to zero, because there are so many different things that are all interacting at the same time, making it more complicated. Because, you know, at the same time you think about, well, things could get cheaper. Yeah, well, then there's also governments that are printing lots of money and inflating the currency back up. So maybe it is the same. Maybe it's more. Uncle Sam.
I guess the question becomes is like, what percentage of the population is their happiness and being content and feeling like they live in a stable society? How much of that is derived from how much money they have and how much money they make? Okay. And of those that do feel that way, that their size of the bank account and how much they get paid is directly correlated to how happy they are about the civilization they live in, is that a big enough percentage where it causes a threshold, where it crosses a threshold where that society collapses because those people revolt? I'm going to take this transcript and put it in Grok so it can tell me what it thinks after we're done.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that is the risk. That's why Elon is scared.
That's why he's going to Mars.
Yeah.
Should have got out of here.
Maybe the fact that we're not having any kids makes, you know, there's going to be less humans to fight over the stuff. So
did you see Japan had 700,000 births and 1.7 million deaths last year?
That is,
and South Korea's worse.
Population decline. Yeah.
That's depressing.
Yep. Let's shift gears for a second. So what do humans do in the future? Like, what do you think? I have some thoughts now on this, and I'm curious to see. So, and we'll frame this. The economy is a system for deciding how to allocate scarce goods and scarce resources. So that's what the economy is.
So what are the scarcest things in a world 50 years from now? So land is very scarce. Oxygen is scarce. Water is scarce. Really, like all the fundamental things that humans need for food, shelter. I guess food. See, that depends on the world's population too. So if we have like a, okay, premium land is very scarce. Let me use a different frame here. So yep. Premium land is very scarce in the future. So for like that example, there is like, okay, so automation, robotics, AI is going to allow us to build super advanced forms of building habitats, places to live. We're also going to have the ability to transport water almost freely because the cost of labor to move that stuff is all autonomous. So it'll be pennies on the dollar, maybe less even, fractions of a penny. And the energy to get that water from point A to point B is going to be basically free because of how much we're going to be able to generate using energy systems like solar and whatever. So you're going to be able to make cities, towns that were traditionally really difficult to build in really beautiful places or places that people want to live, those become a lot easier to access. Okay?
Yep.
So in theory, what happens there is you have a flight of people from what are really nice places today to even nicer places, right? Which opens up the supply of really nice places for people that originally wouldn't have been able to live in those nice places. So like, what's a good example? Malibu, pre-fire, or whatever. Like, you know, let's just say coastline Palisades. Of California. Yeah, Palisades. So all of a sudden, the supply of homes increases in that area because people that have the means to have that house or that land, those people go to like just bumblefuck Idaho in the perfect mountain or Wyoming, and they don't have to worry about any of the logistics around it because it just comes to them. And perhaps they don't even have to deal with the crappy weather because they have an invisible dome around that city that still looks perfectly beautiful, mm-hmm. and it's still at a perfect 75 degrees with just a little bit of a breeze. That's what AI is going to do, right? And then Tesla's going to build that because that's the Mars habitat, baby, right? So, okay. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So in a world like that, in theory, we have more supply of land that people would want to live on, which should bring prices down. But the people that are going to be able to afford those places are going to be the ones that are actually generating an income by matching their natural talent or their natural ability to a market demand that exists that a AI or robot can't do as good of or a better job than they can. That's what the future world looks like. I'm just talking about land start, but yeah. Then I'm like, I somehow shifted to the entire economy. My brain's retarded. I don't even know how it works half the time. But mm-hmm. So did I even ask, what was your question?
Yeah. Like what do people do?
Yeah.
Like what are the future jobs? And just taking into account the fact that the economy, there's gotta be some sort of connection between jobs in the economy, and then the economy is, the allocation of scarce resources.
What will people demand when robots and AI can do everything for you? It's by default, is something that a robot or AI can't do for you. By default, right? So what are those jobs? So it's all connection. It's all human connection driven. It's all human to human interaction.
Like I think professional sports there'll be a proliferation of sports. We'll have way more pro sports than we have today of all sorts of varieties. Too. They'll get crazy. Yeah, there'll be esports, physical sports. I don't think football is going away. It might change a little bit, but people are going to want to see, and then even higher risk sports will get bigger. You might even see, especially in the, in a world
we're all
where
be athletes.
I'm just saying, we probably won't all be athletes, but their athletes will be a big part of the economy. because there will be some people who are athletes and people are going to want to watch athletes.
Well, chess is a good example for that, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly why I think that this is true is, you know, AIs are already better than humans at chess, but chess is bigger today than it's ever been. And it's because it's more accessible to more people and people have more free time to either engage in playing chess or to watch people playing chess. And so, yeah, like people just enjoy watching humans compete in these very intense ways. Chess is one of the most intense, you know, mental competitions that we engage in. And then, yeah, you know, all sorts of different games, football, basketball, you know, real football, American football, basketball and cricket and all these hockey and Olympic sports, track and field, like all these things. Like, I think that's going to get huge. Games,
all
just
kinds
competitions.
Of games. Yeah, competitions and games. Like, you could almost make an argument that, like, what percentage of the corporate world is, like, a game? I got to get a better job. I got to get a better review so I can make more money. Mm-hmm. Like, the money are the points, right? And, like, career advancement is the status. These are all games. So it's like, okay, so what are the new games that we have as a society? Yeah, capitalism is a game. Capitalism is a game.
Yep.
You know? So it's like, what's the new game? It's not capitalism anymore, because capitalism is going to be like the ones that are going to have and deploy the capital are going to be the ones with the biggest AI brains. It's going to be like three players. So Elon, Google, maybe Sam Altman, Jensen, and maybe another person or two, they will win capitalism. Those will be like the you know, like the Mount Rushmore of capitalism. Congratulations, you've won. Mm-hmm. And then they will create the new game. You know, they will create, okay, here's the new game. The new game is whatever.
Yep. But then there's also like exploration. No, like I think, so I don't know, like the future, it doesn't depress me. Like I think it's going to be choppy for a while, that we've got to figure out how to get from here to there. But I think there's a really cool there. You know, so we talked about sports, other types of entertainment. Like I think reality TV gets, you know, a million times bigger than it is today. Then exploration, like actually putting, you know, just because we've sent bots to Mars that create a colony, well, people want to go there. So like visiting these places, exploring first our solar system and then further out and beyond, like humans are going to want to do that. As
people are
going to
live in the Grand Canyon, like straight up.
Yeah. You're going to have the ability to, you know, like as we really figure out healthcare and people's, like, we're going to have a whole new relationship with risk. Like, I think people are going to do things like skydiving and whatever just to feel like to expose themselves to some sort of life or death type risk or risk of pain that they're insulated from. And then, yeah, lots of human to human connection and interaction. You know, it is going to be a strange new world as we do have more and more relationships with artificial intelligences, but there's always going to be it, like, that's, so coming back to the economy, one of the things that's always going to be scarce, if there's a finite number of people, then there's always going to be a finite amount of attention, of human attention that exists. And then how does that get split up? You know, human to human interactions, human to AI interactions, and across all sorts of different domains, whether that's friendship, mentoring, you know, like we talked about earlier, competitions, romantic relationships, that I think that becomes a bigger part of the economy because it's one of the few things that's left that truly is scarce.
Yeah. And what are like the subsets of each one of those things that start fleshing out that industry? you know, like those emerging. So, okay, so the opportunity for emerging industries is going to be akin to a new frontier, right? So like when, yeah, when people started like coming to the United States and they started going westward and creating, you know, all kinds of problems and also making the United States bigger and more powerful, you know, pro and con, unfortunate, yep, but true, has it happened in the history of mankind? So now they start doing that in the realm of artificial, like we start doing that in the realm of artificial intelligence. So like, what are those new? And so by default, that means that the pace of innovation, the impacts to society, all of it is going to be very large. Like the impacts are going to be like massive. They're going to be like giant, boom, boom, boom. Like it's like a giant dinosaur walking through, and each step is like a new thing that's going to come out. Bam, bam. And it's just going to shake the foundation of society every time it happens. And that's going to be part of the choppiness.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be part of the chop. Robotaxi going live in all of Texas at half the cost of Uber is going to be one of those steps, but it's going to be in a local economy.
Yep.
Right. So the question becomes, what are the things that come out that are more at a national, global?
Well, I think one of the ones that's going to be disruptive is one that we've already, you know, it's always been around, but it's really been reaching new heights recently in the United States, and that's sports betting, like this gambling, yeah, that kind of thing will get to be a lot massive, bigger in potentially a way that is, yeah, causes lots of issues.
Real-time betting, like, so if you're watching like a chess game between Hikaru and Magnus, it's like they're gonna have prop bets on like, oh, Hikaru is gonna like make a stupid he's gonna have this face in the next 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, oh, Magnus is about to blunder the queen. Yes. And it's all going to be real time. And you can bet on everything, like fucking everything. Just the smallest little thing. You can bet on each drive, like when you're watching Penn State football. It's like, okay, it's first and 10. You know, it's the second drive of the game. They're going to, you know, what's the likeliest play? You know, it's going to be a run to the left. He's going to pass it. He's going to complete a pass to the slot receiver. It's going to be a touchdown. It's going to be at least a 7-yard gain. And each drive, each play, boom, 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 boom. That's the kind of stuff, right, that you're talking about. It's like that system, that's going to be crazy. That's going to be addicting as fuck. I might get divorced.
Yep. My wife
might leave me. But honey, this is how we make new points. This is how we make the new points. We don't need money anymore. We need karma points. And I can post this as a short on my YouTube channel. Look at how many plays I got correctly back to back. That's not dystopian at all.
Not at all.
Hans, I'm scared. I'm scared, dude. This is crazy. Like once we really start thinking through like the possibilities, it gets really weird really, really, really quickly. But like, okay, you know what's interesting? Well, this conversation for the last half hour, it feels very clear to me. Like this feels like a very solid crystallization of what will happen. It feels that way. Like it feels like there's a high degree of certainty of what we just outlined actually happening. Whereas it's like, how often can we have this conversation, and in how many domains can we have this conversation so we can make a very like, is there a way for us to create a framework where we can generate a high certainty crystallization of what the future is going to look like? You know? Because that's the only way to have a good future from this thing. It's like as many, maximizing the number of people that have the highest, like have a crystallized vision of what the future is going to look like with the highest amount of certainty. Or at least having the framework to figure out how to do that.
I mean, I don't know if having certainty about the future helps or hurts.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I think like a vague sense of hope is probably as good as it gets. having too much knowledge is... You don't want society to be hopeless. Christian. Well, I'm just talking about, you know... If you knew too many things about your future, would that improve your life? Or, and this is like the classic
ignorance
story
bliss,
about
yeah.
time travel, you know, like maybe you die tomorrow. And do you want to know that? Does that help? Does that hurt?
I think that's a very good point.
Yeah. But yeah, I think you want to feel optimistic about the future enough to do what you can to, you know, make that optimistic future a reality.
So are hedge fund managers just automatically depressed because that's their entire job, is to try to predict the future? I wonder what the depression rate is for hedge fund managers. Cool. Bet you it's high.
Well, I think it's really high, but I think part of that is just because of the social
circles. You have to be a depressed individual. If you're a hedge fund manager, let us know if you're depressed.
We can ask Emmett.
Yeah. He doesn't seem depressed to me. I think that's because he eats like 18 eggs a day. You know?
Yeah.
And 20 slices of bacon for breakfast.
And he drives his Cybertruck around. Pinnacle of life.
Yeah. I mean, he seems pretty... But you know what's funny about Emmett, too? It's like he's also a man of faith, too. I really do... I think the one hypothesis you had from a while... I'm really becoming convinced of the idea that the percentage of people that will turn back to faith in the coming decades is going to be a huge reversal from the last few decades trend. I think the uptick in faith is going to be massive because people are going to search for answers, and the real world is not going to give them this is not going to have the answers. The answers lie within. And I think within, the most tried and true forms we have of finding the answer within is through faith and religion. That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah, I mean, there are just a lot of maybe, you know, I don't know if I would phrase it the same way, but there's a lot of metaphysical questions. You know, what is the meaning of life? What is love? Why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? You know, these are some of the hardest questions to answer. And, you know, science just doesn't help with answers to those questions very much. And so if you really want answers to those types of questions, well, then you gotta, you know, come up with something. And that's the, you know, those are the types of questions that humanity's been wrestling with since the dawn of time. And the existing religions are, you know, the most lendy, most tried and true sets of like cohesive answers. You know, you got one philosophy versus another philosophy versus another philosophy that try to answer that. And it, from what I hear, Catholicism specifically is like just undergoing a huge influx right now, that tons and tons of people are joining the Catholic Church, and that's not really translating over to other denominations of Christianity, that it's primarily Catholicism. And I think it's because it is such an old Christian tradition, and like it's a combination of old and highly visible, that, you know, Greek Orthodox and some of the other Eastern Orthodox denominations are as old or older, but at least here, you know, in the United States, they're not nearly as visible. So it's like the big old version of faith. A lot of young people are really attracted to that thing because it's, I guess, the most opposite thing they could do to their atheist millennial or Gen X parents.
Is Mormonism like the newest quote-unquote successful religion that we've had?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Scientology.
I mean, yeah, Scientology is definitely newer. Yeah.
Interesting. I wonder. The reason
are
why
those
I
religions
or
are they cults?
Is there a difference? What isn't a cult, bro? I'm a huge fan of Penn State football. I'm in a fucking cult, brother. You know.
Yeah.
And I
That's
love it.
One of Mark awesome. Andreessen's points is, you know, everything is cults all the way up.
It is. I think that's true. I mean, I think cults is like, it's a more punchy word for community, you know, and a lot of different framings.
Yeah. It depends on the context. A lot of time it's a very self-extinguishing community.
Yes.
So that, like, it feels so good right now, and then all of a sudden, you know, you end up with a lot of dead people. So
yeah. I just wonder if like these next 20 years are going to give birth to like, in like, we're going to have an influx of new religions, you know, that are born, like maybe the existing frameworks are not good enough, you know, your big four or whatever, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and
Buddhism.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep.
I wonder if, like, I don't know, like expansionism, you know, like we have to, like Elon's vision of going to Mars and going through the stars, that's probably going to be a new religion, you know. It's like everything is for the purpose of having humanity on every celestial body. That seems like a pretty good religion to me, and its founding member Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. All hell Elon. You damn well know. Here's the thing. I've actually been thinking through this, dude. It's like, what's the likelihood that 200 years from now, Elon's timeline is going to, like, it, let's say he successfully goes to Mars and he successfully colonizes Mars and he so successfully, he is like the de facto leader of creating a self-sustaining civilization on Mars. That motherfucker is going to get a religion, 100%. And it will be followed and he will be viewed as a religious leader. And he will be immortalized forever, in the same way as Muhammad, Jesus, etc. I really think that. I don't know if I would be a follower of that religion. Mm-hmm. You know, I've given that I lived quote unquote during his time. He's still very human to me, and I don't subscribe to the follow humans at all costs sort of, like, because we're all flawed, and we've seen everyone's flaws all the time. And the ones that try to hide their flaws are the ones you should trust the least. That's the land that I live in. But that impact is going to be very difficult to push away. Or like say, no, don't. Like people are going to have every right to do that if they want. That's going to happen. If he's successful in that, 100%.
Well, and then you combine that, with
that Bible signed.
Yeah.
Elon signed my Bible. So I can sell it for my new points. I'm kidding.
Yeah, your credits for the empire.
Yeah. Elon Bucks.
The crazy thing is that he might, you know, be the founder of a self-sustaining colony on Mars at the same time that he builds humans' first artificial super intelligence.
Yeah.
And, you know, either one of those things is a crazy humanity scale breakthrough, and to accomplish both, like, that's definitely going to, you know, seed a bunch of
new cults. Feel real. Yeah. It doesn't feel real. I mean, like, I think the common theme that I think the reason why people like you and I are always talking about him and the shit that he works on is like the technical execution is the thing that's like the really mind-blowing part of this whole thing. Just the entrepreneurial ability is the thing that's just very difficult to just be like, it's not that big of a deal. No, it's a gigantic deal. And so if the vision actually comes to reality and the execution is actually there from him and his teams and everybody that surrounds that entire structure for all his companies, if they actually execute at the highest level to achieve the ultimate vision, that's going to be truly unbelievable. It doesn't feel real. Like if it happens, it's too good to be true. So by default is if it does happen, the path to get there is going to be disgusting. It is not going to be a pretty path to get there. There is no reality where the path to make those visions a reality is a clean, beautiful, happy path, and then you get this amazing future. No, you either have the amazing future and the whole thing is dog shit, or you have an amazing journey and the end never happens. And so far, we've had a pretty dog shit journey, which means that the end's probably going to happen, you know?
Hopefully, yeah.
That's what it feels like. I mean, the poll came out, right? He's the least popular person in America. I don't know if the poll's right or not, but you know, it's like he's got the lowest approval rating out of anybody. That is a signal to me that says, okay, he's probably going to get that end vision done. It's a very stupid way of thinking about it, but it's like my intuition says, as long as he's alive, mm-hmm. and as long as the path is dirty and ugly, it's going to get done. It's almost like a forcing function, yep. to get it done.
That's like the magnet for what he seeks out.
Correct. What a podcast. This was, how did we get here? This was fun. This was awesome. We should do this more often.